This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have the great pleasure of talking to Anna LaPay. She's the author of a book called Diet for a Hot Planet. The subtitle is The Climate Crisis and at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. And I do want to talk a little bit about the two parts, that it's descriptive and then proscriptive. And so hopefully we can cover all of that. Hi, Anna. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the background, your background, and what got you to become so involved in food and climate.
Sure. Well, in some ways, I suppose I kind of went into the family business. My mother has been researching and writing and thinking about food, especially the root causes of hunger and why it is that there are still so many hungry people on a planet that produces more than enough calories to feed us all. She's been doing that work for going on 40 years. So starting at a really early age, I got kind of brought into her work. I remember licking envelopes for fundraising efforts for her nonprofit organization, you know, before I could even walk. So it's been something that I've been connected to throughout my whole life, but it really became my own passion and interest to explore these questions around food and our relationship to it, how it affects all of our lives directly and indirectly. When I was in graduate school my mother and I wrote a book together called Hope's Edge, and that really set me on this path of exploring these big questions about our relationship to food and how it impacts our lives. And this latest book really came out of a kind of epiphany I had a couple of years ago when I was reading some studies by the United Nations that I was sort of slogging my way through these dense documents about food and climate. And I had always been interested in how climate change is going to affect food supply. You know, will it mean we have less food to feed the world? How does it affect yields? How will it affect crop quality? But I had never really thought about the other side of the equation, which is how our food system itself contributes to the crisis. And these studies started kind of opening that window to me to help me understand that piece of the story, and that became the genesis of my interest in writing what became Diet for a Hot Planet.
I should probably mention, and I should have done this in the intro, but your mother is Frances Moore LePay, and
I should have mentioned that too, right? Yeah, so she wrote a book now, it's the 40th anniversary, called Diet for a Small Planet, 1971. That really helped to connect the dots between our industrial food system and growing hunger in the world. And in a lot of ways, this book is obviously, the title is a direct, indirect relationship to that book. And it's really saying, look, this is all part of one conversation. In 1971, my mother elucidated the social and economic impacts of industrial food, and what I'm exposing in Diet for a Hot Planet are the environmental impacts, specifically this direct connection between industrial agriculture, especially confinement livestock, and the climate crisis, that our food chain from kind of seed to agricultural chemicals to the farms, to the factories that produce our food, to the supermarkets that sell it, add up to about 33% of all greenhouse gas emissions.
Right. I think that actually it's a really important thing to bring forward. I think a lot of the discussion about climate change gets reduced into big ideas, and that help people not focus on the things that they can do or the things that are going on in their daily lives. And it's not about guilt. You're not trying to make people feel guilty. Oh my God, you know, I eat, therefore I contribute to the climate crisis. It sort of leads to a nihilism that, for a lot of people would be difficult. But I think what you're trying to point out is that there is a structural issue, and that if you can talk about what is really going on and identify what the problems are, you can actually come up with alternatives that will change the way, at least have some impact in reducing the amount of greenhouse gases, so that for the future, since we're talking about, you know, the things that we do this year are going to stay with the planet for 30 years. So
that's
things that we're
not longer. That's right. And I think often food is described as kind of, or agriculture is kind of painted as a victim of the climate crisis. There was just this huge New York Times article about feeding the future in a climate unstable future. And it was really presented as, you know, agriculture is going to be the victim of unstable weather and more droughts and more floods. And what does that mean to food supply? And what was entirely missing from the frame of the story are the kind of the two parts of the story, two additional parts of the story that I think are much more important and much more interesting, which is one, how is agriculture and how is the food system more broadly contributing to the crisis? But secondly, how can the way we raise food, our relationship to food, be part of the solution? In other words, how can it be part of both mitigating, in other words, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and helping us adapt? And that's what, to me, was really exciting about writing this book, is that more and more studies, and there's been even more studies since I finished the book, are coming out showing that organic farming techniques, sustainable farming techniques, agroforestry, in other words, planting trees, integrating trees on farmland, and all these techniques on the farm mean a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, mean a reduction of energy use, and also mean increasing carbon content in the soils. In other words, sequestering that carbon, pulling that carbon out of the atmosphere, which we know we need to do to help mitigate the crisis, and much more. In other words, there is this way that food becomes a really central pathway to getting ourselves out of this crisis. And it's a real missed opportunity, I feel, because people aren't talking about food and farming in that way.
Well, no, and I think one of the issues that we face with, especially with agriculture, is that, as you point out, there are, I mean, the system that we have of industrial agriculture has been built up over a long period of time. And as with any centralized, corporatized element of our society and economics, it has gained power. And, you know, the power interests then, you know, the system seeks to sustain itself. So it doesn't, you know, when you're talking about large-scale industrial agriculture, you're talking about very large companies that have a vested interest in the system as it currently exists. So,
that's right. And what I think people don't understand when they hear this term industrial agriculture, I mean, I think still a lot of people wouldn't even have a working definition of what that means. So just to be really clear, what it means is this very dramatic change in how we raise crops and how we raise animals in the past 100 years, but especially post-World War II, that is entirely dependent on inputs, in other words, entirely dependent on synthetic chemicals, on synthetic fertilizer. Many of those chemicals are highly toxic to people as well as to animals. And it means shifting animals off of the farm and into what are called confinement animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, where they are fed on a heavy diet of pharmaceuticals, so lots of antibiotics, lots of other drugs, antibacterials, arsenic-based drugs in the case of poultry. You know, really not what we would necessarily be excited to hear is in our food. And what I think people then don't get, because we don't fully understand the sort of the complexity of what industrial farming means, is that we don't see then, as you said, who are the interests who have so much at stake in this industry and in this way of organizing our food chain. And when you start looking at the process, you realize it's big oil, it's the fossil fuel industry. Synthetic fertilizer is made with an incredible amount of natural gas. It takes 33,000 cubic feet of natural gas to produce one ton of synthetic fertilizer. A lot of the chemicals used in agriculture are petroleum-based. It's also a huge sector of profits for the chemical industry. So companies like Dow, DuPont have a huge interest in agriculture. Third, it's a huge market for the pharmaceutical industry. You know, we typically think big pharma means drugs for people, but actually confinement livestock is a huge market for the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, I could go down the list, but you're talking about some of the most powerful sectors of industry in our country that have a lot at stake in getting us to uphold the status quo. I was just debating a man who is described as an environmental scientist who works at an organization called the American Enterprise Institute, which is heavily funded by the fossil fuel industry as well as all those industries that I just mentioned. And I was debating with him on NPR yesterday, and he was talking about, well, you have to admit, you know, industrial agriculture is just more efficient. And his argument for that is, well, you go to the grocery store and look how expensive organic food is, as if the price of food at the supermarket were somehow directly in correlation with the efficiency of production. But he said in that debate a number of things that are just patently untrue. Coming from a think tank that's funded by the industries that want us to believe a certain way about food, I was myself highly skeptical of his perspective, and of course, knowing the facts, was highly frustrated to try to debate with somebody who was just out and out lying.
Well, and the other issue that you expose there, I think, is the embedded external costs. That, you know, if something is cheap at the supermarket, it's partially because the external costs and downstream costs are hidden, and they're they're taken into the environment as if the environment was somehow free. You know, that's sort of but it's very difficult to argue that in an economic system which is based on treating the planet itself as a sinkhole for external costs.
Mm-hmm. And so, that those who are the polluters of the planet, of our water, of our air, are not having to pay those costs. In other words, as you put it, they aren't having to internalize those costs. They can be externalized. And so you have new data coming out of the EPA that found that the areas in the country that have the highest rates of air pollutants are not our inner cities, are not our dense urban areas like you might think. They're actually the air above confined animal feeding operations. In other words, there's such waste concentrated on those plants that the air is much, much more polluted than you find in our cities. And those companies that run those essentially factories aren't required to pay for the most part for that pollution. They're not considered factories, and therefore they don't fall under the same regulation and jurisdiction. And so all of those costs that you and I have to bear are not borne by those companies, and also are not reflected in the price of that food.
Well, and then there is the other issue of the if food is not healthy but it's cheap, then there's another cost that society bears in terms of medical care for people who get sick because they eat bad food. But that's mm-hmm. that is a difficult argument to win when people are talking about cost. Low cost equals good. It's difficult to sustain a holistic economic argument when people are refusing to accept what would be otherwise invisible costs. I guess this is really a big question for me when, you know, having read the book and I've thought a lot about these issues for many, many years, it's frustrating, and this is a kind of ongoing conversation that I'm amazed that you are able to keep your optimism in the face of such difficulty. It's not just the numbers that you come up with and talk about in the book, but you also have positive solutions.
Right.
And I think that I want to believe that we can actually make a change. I really want that to happen, but I'm so worried, as I think a lot of people are, that until big crises occur, people don't act. That it's
right.
Very difficult to get people to get out of their daily routine, which they're comfortable with and which works for them, and see that there's something else that they can do.
Well, and again, here's where I feel like talking about food and engaging in trying to change food itself is exciting, because I think you're right. I think people, but I think that it's also people just feel powerless and feel confused about how can they make change on something as massive, both sort of massive and global, but also amorphous and hard to kind of directly see your relationship to something like climate change. And I think what I'm seeing certainly in the past 10 years in this country and also globally is the sense that food is probably one of the most tangible things that we directly connect with that connects to our environment, right? You know, food and farming has one of the largest impacts on the planet. I mentioned climate change. It's also industrial agriculture and farming in general uses 70% of all fresh water on the planet. 40% of the planet's land mass is used in farming or ranching, in addition to those 33% of greenhouse gas emissions. So you're talking about this huge impact, but what people are really discovering is that there are these really direct ways to get involved in one's own community with trying to kind of re-knit a more sustainable relationship to food within community. And that's emerging not just through people kind of wishful thinking it to happen. It's emerging out of really concerted effort and focused work, so that you now can kind of rattle off statistics like the fact that the USDA or Department of Agriculture just released the latest figures of farmers markets in this country, and there are more than 6,000 farmers markets all across the U.S. when just a few decades ago there were only 100, that you now have farm-to-school programs, in other words, farms that are directly bringing fresh food into schools in schools in every single state in the union. And that's, again, emerged just in the past decade. You have a resurgence of young people starting to get into organic farming. I do a lot of speaking on college campuses. Every single college campus I've been to in the last few semesters has a working farm on their campus now. Many of them have started 1, 2, 3, 4 years ago. So these are efforts that are multifaceted. They're about connecting people to healthy food. They're about connecting people to community, connecting people to cultural traditions. But also, I would argue, these are part of the solutions to global warming, you know, that having a sustainable food supply is really part of helping us adapt to climate change and help us reduce emissions from the food sector.
Well, and I think you've hit on something really important, too, and that is that over the last 50 to 100 years, not just in the United States, but all around the world, you have a migration out from agricultural communities and the industrialization of agriculture, so that it becomes we become more of an urban suburban society. Fewer people
right.
are on the land, fewer people are involved with the land, and that's, you know, you've got to see a reversal of that. I think it's really it has to be more than just the small numbers of people that we have now. I think we've got to see that build into a movement where relationships between cities and the agricultural land around them can be restored. Suburbia is ultimately, in some ways, the enemy of the good here, because not only does suburbia take up agriculturally valuable land, it changes the lifestyle of people who live in it, so that they have to drive everywhere. They can't just shop in local communities. They can't walk to a farm stand. Everything has to be in the car. So it seems like, and I hope there is a movement of people into agriculture that can kind of pick up momentum and see more and more people returning to small-scale farming in areas that are close to where people live.
Yeah, and then I also think when you look at what are the conditions that people live in outside of these industrialized countries like the United States, what you find is that still the majority actually of people are still living in rural communities, that, you know, there's still 2.6 billion people on the planet who are involved with agriculture. It's 40% of the global population. And these people are among the world's most undernourished. But what we're starting to see is this kind of confluence of factors that are pointing to the fact that in order to raise those people out of poverty, in order to ensure that the most hungry on the planet are well fed, the way to do that is through really helping to promote and expand what many call knowledge-intensive agriculture or these organic farming practices that are not about getting those billions of people hooked on buying expensive chemicals, expensive fertilizer, expensive seeds from companies half a world away, but getting those farmers to have access to local indigenous seeds, to knowledge about how to build healthy soil without synthetic fertilizer, those kinds of things. And that is the solution both to ending hunger, but it's also, again, this solution to producing a food supply without undermining our natural resources and, of course, contributing to the climate crisis.
So do you want to maybe talk a little bit about the seven principles of a climate-friendly diet? Because I think that is really important. I don't want to, ignore the rest of the book. I think there's a lot of great stuff there, but I'd love to have you talk a little bit about, the positive things that people can focus on in their daily lives.
Yeah, great. So when I was writing the book and I started exploring, what is it that you and I can do? And of course, we eat every day. If we're lucky, we eat multiple times a day. And, what are the choices we can make about food on our plate that is supporting this kind of lower carbon intensive diet? And what you find when you start exploring that question is that the answer, thankfully, becomes a lot of the same that you hear about what is the principles of good, healthy diet for your body. So that, in other words, what's good for the planet, it also, no surprise, turns out to be good for us people. So the principles are things that probably many people already might be trying to embrace, but just not perceiving them as climate-friendly choices, things like trying to find sustainably produced or organic food, again, because those production methods do not rely at all or very little on synthetic fertilizers, synthetic chemicals, really greenhouse gas emissions intensive production when it comes to humanely and sustainably raised animals. You're talking about much less emissions from that production system. So that's one choice. And again, that's also a choice that's good for our bodies. Last year, the President's Cancer Panel published its latest report, and it found that there are 1,400 pesticides registered by the EPA that are on the market today that have been linked to various forms of cancer and other really serious health impacts. And the cancer panel basically said, the best thing you can do is try to find food that hasn't been raised with pesticides or hasn't been raised with hormones when it comes to meat. And, they didn't use the word organic, but that's basically what they were saying to do. So this is also a choice that's good for our bodies. The second principle that I think is a really key one, depending on where you are already in your consumption levels of meat and dairy, is to reduce the amount of meat and dairy, but especially from kind of what 99% of what you find in a typical American grocery store is meat and dairy coming out of these confined feedlot operations. They really are just the most energy intensive, not to mention water wasteful and all kinds of other problems with them. But producing sort of every time you look at greenhouse gas emission data related to individual food items, beef almost every time comes out as the kind of worst guy in the room. So reducing your amount of meat and dairy consumption is something we can do. Again, depending on where you are, you might already be somebody who chooses to only eat meat on the rare occasion that you can find chicken from a local farmer. In that case, you're in a very different place than the typical American. But the typical American could really reduce meat and dairy consumption. And again, this is when you look at some of the recommendations from the WHO or there's a Global Council on Cancer, their recommendations are to reduce especially red meat consumption too. So a good health choice as well. The third thing, and another one that I think is really important that again is good for our bodies as well, is to try as much as possible to eat food that hasn't been heavily processed. Again, it probably comes as no surprise to listeners that a strawberry you you get from a local, I get here in Brooklyn from my local farm on Long Island, is going to have much less energy embedded in it than, say, a so-called strawberry Pop-Tart that has dozens of ingredients, most of them imported in from China, heavily processed, you know, high manufacturing process to produce those chemicals, very little relationship to an actual strawberry, and, of course, not so nutritionally beneficial either. So reducing your processed food consumption when and how and where you can is another one of the principles I talk about.
Do you want to keep going?
I could.
Yeah.
The other ones, again, you know, I stress these are not in and of themselves that complicated and sometimes not even that hard to do. And there are things like some of the other principles include trying to waste less food. Landfills all around the world emit a really powerful greenhouse gas called methane. And so reducing the amount of waste in our landfills is one strategy to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It turns out in a lot of cities, food makes up between 30 to 50% of the waste filling our landfills. So to the extent that we personally can try to reduce the waste coming out of our own homes, our food waste, but also, you know, trying to think about helping institutions we might be connected to reduce their waste. So there's a great movement on college campuses called the Real Food Challenge, trying to help schools choose more sustainable food. And one of their platforms is waste less food, you know, trying to get school cafeterias to not dump out as much food as they do, or to take the food that they are wasting and turn it into something highly productive and highly ecological, like compost that they can use in their community or even on the school's own farm. So wasting less food is another key thing to connect that food, make that food climate connection.
You know, I think actually that one, and I think there that it's really important to talk about waste. Reducing waste is hugely beneficial. It also helps us learn to pay attention to what we buy, because if if you don't buy things that you, I mean, we're used to America in particular, we're used to being able to go to the grocery store, buy whatever you need, bring it home, and of course you end up not using it all. And that's partially, again, it goes back to the suburban lifestyle. You make one trip a week to the supermarket. You don't necessarily know what you will eat the rest of that week. So sometimes you buy things you don't need or you buy too much. It's easy to compost. So it's really easy to redirect a lot of your downstream waste, even if you continue to make mistakes about how much you eat. But the more you compost, the more acutely aware you become of how much food you don't eat, because you're watching as you throw it away. You're separating the you separate your garbage, you throw away the heavy stuff or the meat stuff, and you you take your vegetable and all the plant material and you put it in a compost, and you realize how much there is that we don't eat. So I think that's really important. The other thing you talk about, which I think is hugely powerful in terms of driving change into the system, which is to eat local as much as you can. It has multiple benefits, one being that every time you eat food that's imported from somewhere else, even if it's another part of the country, you're adding energy use into that food. You're basically eating oil that shouldn't be used, for your food.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that was a little bit surprising to me when I was doing research for the book is finding out that so many of the, so many people talk about the importance of eating local and say, the transportation emissions have this huge impact on the kind of footprint of our food. And while we shouldn't ignore those transportation emissions, what actually we have found is that they tend to be a smaller portion of the overall emissions of a particular food item. In other words, in this one study out of Carnegie Mellon found on average the typical U.S. food item, only 10% of the associated emissions came from transportation and the majority came from production. Now, does that mean we should all be buying asparagus from Chile? No. And part of the reason why the answer is no is because a lot of the environmental conditions in which that food produced from far away, a lot of those environmental conditions are really concerning and have their own emissions associated with them. But the other reason why we shouldn't just write off the whole relationship between local food and both climate as well as other environmental benefits is that we know that having good, sustainable farms on the land, that we know that there are all kinds of other, what are often called co-benefits, which never sounded that exciting to me. But basically, there's all these other beneficial things that a good farm does. It helps keep your water clean. It helps provide land and refuge for wildlife, for birds, for insects, beneficial insects. It also, again, it helps bring real fresh, the freshest food you could possibly get to eaters. You know, there's great studies that show that the longer food takes to go from harvest to our plate, a lot of foods actually lose nutrition along the way. So there are all kinds of other benefits to having both environmental and social benefits to having farms in your region, to supporting local food.
Well, and the other extension of that is the ability that every one of us has, if you have any kind of land at all or access to land, is to garden yourself and to reconnect yourself to the process of growing. Not only mm-hmm. do you end up, you know, you get the benefit of growing your own food, but you also help, you know, especially if children, help them learn where food comes from. And so mm-hmm. and that kids, you know, if we all live in a society where agriculture takes place somewhere else other than locally, other than in your own backyard, that kids actually don't know how the food that they eat ever arrived. You know, they're
that's right.
And that the sensitization or the desensitization of people to their environment is part of being disconnected from the food process itself. I think you mentioned this when I heard you give a talk recently, which was that the Victory Gardens during World War II were responsible for some, I think it was 30% of all the food that was eaten in America at that time.
It was 44% of all non-protein food. So we weren't growing a lot of, you know, cows on those Victory Gardens. So separate out protein and people were getting 44% of their calorie needs from Victory Gardens. In other words, from home gardens in cities and in communities around the country.
Yeah, I think it would be an amazing you know, kind of almost like a campaign to get people to, you could consider them Victory Gardens in a different way. You know, it's not about war. It's about, you know, victory for your personal lifestyle or victory over climate change or whatever.
That's right.
But it
That's
would be
right.
an, I think it would be a really powerful thing if we could come back to even 30% or third, you know, or 25%. Mm-hmm. There would be huge benefits for America.
That's right.
And for the world. Well, you know, the other thing, just be, you know, I know we don't have much more time, but you had mentioned in the book a couple of places that you went, which are doing the kinds of environmentally climate-friendly farming. They're really consciously building a different sort of agriculture, and maybe you could talk about one in particular. I think New Forest Farm, I thought, was really, really interesting. Maybe you could just talk about them a little bit.
Sure, and it's a great note to end on because it is so hopeful. So one of the farms that I profile in the book to kind of give people a sense of what a climate-friendly farm looks like and feels like is a farm in Wisconsin called New Forest Farm. And what's important to know about this farm is that 13 years before I was there, it looked like every other farm surrounding it, which it was just growing one crop, corn, basically, or switching corn and soy. And it was a farm that had a lot of chemical use on it and was entirely dependent on synthetic fertilizer. And it was just, you know, rows and rows and rows of one crop. And this incredible farmer, Mark Shepard, took it over and spent the first couple years really getting to know the land, getting to know the region, discovering what crops grow well there, what trees were native to the region, and started planting those. And he, over the years, has, I think, in one spot alone, he said he had something like 142 different species growing of different plants, shrubs and trees and berry bushes and annuals and perennials. And what was really incredible about his farm, and he himself was kind of wowed by how much this had been true there, is that in just these 13 years, he had seen this land completely come back to life. So when he first got there, you know, you'd barely hear the sound of a bird. You would barely see an insect. You know, these are the animals that are either driven away or killed off by our toxic pesticides on typical farmland, right? And when I was interviewing him, he said that he and his wife just a few weeks earlier had seen that in the pocket ponds, his little ponds on his land, that that the frogs were back for the first time. And just standing with him on his farm, I mean, you could hear the drone of all the insects buzzing and around you and feel the sort of vibrancy of the land. The other key, and this is, again, something that he himself was so excited about, is that in the process of really transforming the land, he was, of course, growing a lot of food, producing a lot of food. This was highly efficient. But he had also so rehabilitated the soil that the soil had become both this incredible carbon sink, had, it was rich in carbon, soil carbon, but it also was acting as this powerful sponge. You can picture kind of a really big sponge that is able to absorb a lot of water, so that the floods that had hit the region just before I arrived to meet him and visit the farm that had devastated so many of the surrounding farms, they barely affected his crops. I think he lost about 4% of his crops that happened to be planted in the lowest lying area of his farm. But the rest of his farm was great, and the reason why is because that soil was so able to absorb that water, and so designed, thanks to Mark, to be able to handle that kind of deluge of rain. And because he planted trees and shrubs and low-lying plants, there was a way that the trees kind of broke the fall of the deluge of the rain, so it didn't so pound the ground and therefore erode the soil. And so he was able to really withstand this flood that, like I said, devastated the farms that I passed by on my way to visit him. And to me, this was, you know, exactly the kind of farm we're going to need. We know we're going to have more floods. You know, we know we're going to have more droughts. And we need farms that have that soil that's designed to be able to handle that kind of extreme weather.
Well, I think that's a really, you know, that's a very interesting point, especially for all of us as we, you know, we see the news and we see that, you know, places are getting more rain. It's sort of, you think about it, it's almost the way the Dust Bowl occurred. It was not just a natural event. It was the result of human intervention on the land, which changed the natural environment so that otherwise acceptable natural big weather events would become devastation. So maybe, you know, that I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, I think this book is it's a wonderful book. I think people should, you know, I hope a lot of people will read it, because that we need to do so much, and people need tools to help them think about ways that they can actually make change themselves that is positive for everyone, and not feel like you are, as you said earlier, powerless, because we're not powerless. We are capable of making change, but I think a lot of people really need encouragement and tools, and I think Diet for a Hot Planet provides that. I also should mention your websites and organizations that people can visit and learn more from and participate in, which is www.smallplanet.org and www.takeabite.cc. Anything else you want to add in?
I think that's it. I think I've really enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Thank you, Anna.